one knee and cupped his hands together. She expelled a long, ragged breath, took hold of the reins with one hand, the cantle with the other, and placed her left foot on his hands. He gave her a strong boost, she swung her right leg over the horse's rump, and she was in the saddle. The horse snorted and shifted. She squealed and reached wildly for the bridle. He caught her arms just in time. "Easy," he murmured. To the horse or to her, she couldn't be sure. "Easy." Then he lifted his eyes to her, the most reassuring eyes she'd gazed into since her father had passed away. "Don't worry, I'll keep you safe." "I should have asked you to be my groom instead of my husband," she said. He only grinned. "Hold on." He led the horse to a slow walk. Mercy, the ground must be 50 feet below her and receding. She'd forgotten what it was like to sit up so high on a great big stallion. She knew the horse's motion was gentle and smooth beneath her, but she felt herself perched atop a wild bronco about to be heaved off any second. An incipient nausea roiled her tummy. She wanted to throw her arms about the horse's neck, clamp her legs around its belly, and hang on for all she was worth. She wanted to get off this instant. "You're not really Lord Tremaine, are you?" she said, desperate for distraction. "You're a pauper who looks like him, and the two of you decided to switch places, fool everyone, and have a jolly old time." He laughed. "Well, I am a pauper, an impoverished nobody, as you so aptly put, except I'm already related to every royal house in Europe. So sometimes I put on my fancy clothes and go out and drink champagne with my noble cousins. Sometimes I change into rags and work in the stable. In truth, we shouldn't even have kept horses, but my father said then we might as well stop wearing hats and shoes. It was one economy I could not persuade him to make." His answer was so breathtakingly frank that she momentarily forgot her fear of an imminent tumble. "And your parents permitted this folly?"
"They turned a blind eye and pretended that somehow I was able to run the house better and for less expense without ever dirtying my own hands, or running betting games at whichever lyceum I happened to be attending."
"Betting games?"
"Games that tend to run true to probability. So I could promise a prize of, say, £1, and charge my fellow Lyceans, particularly those who suffer at mathematics, a shilling a try to line up 6 coins heads up while blindfolded. I always came out ahead."
"Good Lord," she breathed. "Did you ever get caught?"
"For having a few coins in my pocket," he chuckled. "No, I was the most courteous, virtuous, promising young man any professor had ever seen."
There was such lovely mischief in his voice. He was courteous, virtuous, as far as she could tell, and infinitely promising. But he was also clever, cunning, and willing to bend the rules. Why did the fates tempt her so? Why must he be so marvellously perfect for her, and yet so abysmally unattainable? "Is there anything you can't do?"
"No," he said, laughing. "But there are things I can't do very well. I'm a terrible cook, for instance. I tried, but my family refused to live on my frugal meals."
The very idea of it shocked her. Even before he became Lord Tremaine, he'd been cousin to dukes and princes. This man, whose blood was so blue it was probably indigo, had worked before a stove, and, success or not, produced at least one entire meal. What next? The Prince of Wales laying down railroad tracks with his own bare hands? An even more shocking thought occurred to her. "Did you plan to work for a living?"
"I did, but lately I've become hesitant. A title does hamper things, even if it's only a courtesy title. For now,
I suppose running an estate is a noble and time-consuming task. He shrugged, his sleeve brushing the edge of her skirts. But it's not what I'd have chosen to do.
And what would you have chosen?
Engineering, he answered easily. I study mechanics at the Polytechnique.
Your parents said something about physics or economics.
My parents are still in denial. They think mechanics sound too common, too much grease and smoke and soot.
But why engineering?
Her father had worked with dozens of engineers. They were an earnest and rather single-minded tribe, seemingly having nothing at all in common with the elegant Marquis beside her. I like to build things, to work with my hands.
She shook her head. Hands. The future Duke liked manual labour. Well, don't tell anyone else what you've told me, she cautioned. They wouldn't understand at all.
I don't. I only told you because you spend as much time with your accountants and solicitors as you do your dressmaker. You are pushing to define a new normality as surely as I am.
She'd never thought of herself quite that way.
She was more an idiosyncratic ignorer of established boundaries than a glutton for the new and the uncharted. But perhaps they were one and the same, each one implying the other. She looked at him, at his calm, unhurried progress, his gloved hand holding on securely to the horse's tether. His other hand he extended to the lower branches of the old willow, brushing their supple tips. She began, and did not finish.
The old willow. They were going by the old willow, which was at least a furlong away from the hitching post. She couldn't believe it.
Yet, as she glanced back, the hitching post in the distance was the size of a matchstick. Yes, he prompted her, keeping up their stately pace. She looked back one more time to make certain her eyes hadn't cheated her. There was no mistake. She'd come some 200 yards, her nausea having dissipated somewhere along the way, her hands no longer gripping the reins, but holding them loosely, almost casually. Somehow, in animated conversation with him, the impossible had happened. She'd forgotten her fear, and her body had relaxed into a comforting, familiar rhythm.
We've done more than 50 yards, I think, she murmured.
He looked behind. So we have.
You knew we'd gone past 50 yards long ago, didn't you?
He didn't answer her directly. Would you like me to help you dismount?
Would she?
Suddenly she felt dizzy again, not with fear, but with the exhilarating absence of it. The way simple, robust health felt a blessing and a miracle after a long, painful illness. No, she didn't want to dismount. She wanted to ride, to hurtle along in a mad dash. He stepped back. Go ahead, he said. So she did. It felt wonderful, the sensation as new as the first shoots of spring, as weightless as walking on water. She gave in to the moment, to the euphoria of once again being young and fearless. The horse, as if sensing her elation, flew. If she could distill the sensations that flooded her, the headlong rush, the metrical, earthy hoofbeats pounding away beneath her, the dense evergreen woods tearing by at the periphery of her vision, and the cold wind that was utterly powerless before the fire of her exuberance, she would have the essence of joy. She heard herself laugh, all breathless, incredulous delight. She urged the horse to even greater speed, feeling its strength and spirit radiate into her every organ and sinew. Only as the horse sped up the next incline did she rein it to a stop, then turned it around. Lord Tremaine was there in the distance. He set his thumb and forefinger against his teeth, and whistled, a piercing note of conspiratorial celebration. She grinned, feeling her mirth spread from ear to ear, and answered his call, galloping back toward him as if she were a medieval knight at tournament and he her striking post. He ran toward her, as light-footed and swift as a creature of the African savannah, and reached her just as she slowed. She unhooked her feet from the stirrups and threw herself into his waiting arms. He easily took the impact of her momentum and weight, lifting her high in the air and spinning her around. "I did it!" she yelled, unladylike and thrilled. "You did it!" he cried at almost the exact same moment. They grinned hugely at each other. He set her down, but left his hands around her waist. She happily let her hands remain on his shoulders. "I couldn't have done it without you."
"Don't encourage me. I'm not so modest to begin with." She laughed.
"Excellent. I hate modesty with a passion." And loved him to distraction. He had done it. He had cajoled and wheedled and lured her out of her self-imposed exile from all things equestrian, and restored a treasured joy to her life. Her hands crept toward his collar, and then, before she knew it, she was cradling his face in her palms, the tips of her ring fingers brushing at his earlobes. He went still, the laughter in his eyes transmuting to a dark, quiet intensity, almost forbidding if he hadn't momentarily chewed on his lower lip. She carved a thumb along his cheekbone, tracing its subtle contour, feeling the weight and the heat of his unwavering, unblinking stare. This was, or should be, their moment, the coming together of two kindred souls in an instant of ecstatic camaraderie. She spread her fingers, pushing her kidskin-clad fingertips into his hair, pulling his head down toward hers. She wanted him. She needed him. They were perfect for each other. One kiss, just one kiss. And he'd know it too, not just deep in his heart, but foremost on his mind. He didn't stop her. He was compliant to the gentle pressure of her hands, his eyes gazing down at her with an almost befuddled wonder. Bliss erupted in her. He'd seen the light. He'd at last understood the unique, rare splendor of their bond. They came so close she could count his eyelashes, and no closer. "I can't," he said, his voice barely above a whisper. "I'm pledged to another." Her bliss turned to cold daggers in her heart. Her limbs froze. But disbelief still reigned, like a mother's denial over a child's abrupt and senseless death. "You really want to marry Miss von Schreppenberg?"
"I've told her that I would," he answered obliquely.
"Does she care?"
Gigi could barely keep the bitterness out of her voice. He sighed. "I care." Her hands dropped. The pain in her chest was her hopes charring to ashes. But still those hopes smouldered, pinpricks of unbearable light in piles of hot cinder.
"And what if you hadn't pledged yourself to her?"
"What if my departed cousin had chosen a less fateful way to express his disdain for the great city of London?"
His eyes were such raw intoxication, all ruinous gentleness and wistful resignation.
"Life is intractable enough as it is. Don't torment yourself with what-ifs."
The opportunities she'd lost with Carrington's death had not beleaguered her, because they were only those of title and privilege, a business alliance fallen through. She was the daughter of an entrepreneurial man. She understood that even the most careful nurturing didn't always yield the fruits one sought. With Lord Tremaine, she'd lost all detachment and perspective.
"You have already proposed to Miss von Schreppenberg?"
"I will."
He was unequivocal.
"When I hear from her next."
Slowly, unwillingly, she began to understand that, for good or ill, he intended to marry Miss von Schweppenberg. Neither the prospect of riches nor the promise of carnal delight would lure him away from this chosen path. Her entire happiness, something she hadn't even known she remotely cared about, had hung on his answer. And he'd doomed her. He might as well have shot the stallion out from under her as she galloped toward him in feckless rapture.
"I'm sure you'll be very happy together," she said.
A lifetime of training under Mrs. Rowland was barely enough to force that platitude past her larynx with any semblance of dignity. He bowed and handed the reins of the horse to her. "The day flees. You'll return home faster, riding." He helped her mount. They shook hands again as they bid each other good day. This time, he did not linger in his touch. Half a mile out, it hit Gigi that Lord Tremaine didn't know exactly where Miss von Schweppenberg was. Last season, Mrs. Rowland, in a mood of largesse, had invited the Countess and Miss von Schweppenberg to attend a garden party. They'd declined, with a longish note full of regret from Miss von Schweppenberg, as they'd have departed London already. Gigi had thought it strange that a team with nothing but advantageous marriage on their mind would leave before the most fruitful time of year for proposals, the end of July. She was, however, not surprised to later hear of rumours that pressing debts had forced the von Schweppenbergs to leave town sooner than they'd wished. Perhaps they'd underestimated the cost of a London season. Perhaps such was their usual practice, and this time they misjudged the patience of their landlord and creditors. She hadn't cared then to find out what exactly was the case, and she didn't now. The important thing was that Lord Tremaine's intelligence on Miss von Schweppenberg's whereabouts and goings-on at any given point in time wasn't much better than Gigi's. And if Miss von Schweppenberg's waffling stance was any indication, he was by far the more reliable correspondent of the two. Part of her recoiled at the direction of her thoughts. "Beyond this point there be monsters." But just as a locomotive hurtling at full speed could not be stopped by a mere wooden fence across the tracks, her thoughts rumbled on to the defiant clickety-clack of "if only, if only, if only." If only Miss von Schweppenberg were already married. Or if only Lord Tremaine came to believe, somehow, that such was the case. "Do not consider such a thing," begged her good sense. "Do not even think it." But her good sense was no match for the wrenching pain in her heart, for her crushing need of him. She could bear everything, if only she could have him for a year, a month, a day. If he would not offer her this opportunity, then she'd create it herself, by fair means or foul, at whatever cost, come plague or locust. Chapter 7. The 13th of May, 1893. The hansom cab stopped. "You're out, Gov," said the driver. A long line of landaus and Clarences filled the curb up and down from the Tremaine townhouse. His wife was having herself a party, it seemed, with some 30-40 people in attendance. Camden had been gone 4 days to visit his parents. Was she celebrating his disappearance off the face of the earth already? The butler, though distressed to see his return, hid it well under a layer of huffy solicitude. "Milord must be tired. Would Milord care for a bath, a shave, dinner delivered to his room?" Camden half expected an offer of laudanum, too, to tumble Milord into a quick, insensate slumber so that Milady's soiree could continue unhindered. "Are more people expected?" he asked. There would be, if there was to be a ball.
No, sir, Goodman answered stiffly. It is only a dinner.
Camden consulted his watch. 10:30. The guests should be in the drawing room by now, both the men and the women, getting ready to take their leave in the next half hour, in order to make the rounds of balls and soirées dansantes. He pushed open the double door to the drawing room and saw his wife first, splendid in a surfeit of diamonds and ostrich feathers. Next to her stood an exceptionally handsome man who, with a frown on his face, seemed to be admonishing her. She listened to him with an expression of exaggerated patience. Slowly, one by one, then by twos and threes, the guests realized who had come amongst them, even though none of them had ever met him. The hum of conversation faded, until even she had to glance at the door to see what had caused the hush. Her mouth tightened as she registered his presence, but she let not a second pass before putting on a bright, false smile and coming toward him. "Camden, you're back. Come, do meet some of my friends. They're all dying to make your acquaintance." Such breathtaking insolence, such cheek, such bollocks. He hoped Lord Frederick liked wearing skirts. Camden took his wife by the elbows and kissed her lightly on the forehead. He had heard that he had the most courteous marriage known to man. Far be it from him to argue otherwise. "Of course, I would be delighted." Following her lead, her guests received him amicably, though most of them didn't quite achieve her smoothness. The handsome man from her tête-à-tête she introduced last, by which time he was standing by a tall brunette, as uncommonly fine-looking as himself. "Allow me to present Lord Tremaine," said his wife. "Camden, Lord and Lady Renworth." So this was Lord Renworth, the ideal gentleman, according to Mrs. Rowland, and Gigi's erstwhile lover. "A pleasure, my lord," said Lord Renworth, with all the creamy innocence of a man who had never cuckolded Camden. Camden found he was almost enjoying himself. He appreciated a fine bit of farce. "Likewise. You wouldn't be the same Felix Renworth who authored that fascinating article on the capture of comets by Jupiter." This took everyone aback, especially Lady Tremaine. "Are you an astronomy enthusiast as well, my lord?" asked Lady Renworth, her tone tentative. "Most assuredly, my dear lady," Camden answered with a smile. His wife glanced uneasily at her former lover. The guests, faced with the choice of either being the first to observe and gossip about the Tremaines appearing in public together or attending a ball not so different from the one they went to 3 days ago, forgot to leave. Camden did not disappoint. He was a charming host, but better than that, he was candid to a degree. How long did he intend to stay in England? 1 year, at least. How did he like his house? His house, which he liked exceedingly well, was on 5th Avenue in Manhattan, but he found his wife's house agreeable enough. Was not Lady Tremaine looking very fine tonight? Fine was much too tame a word. He'd known Lady Tremaine since she was practically an infant, and she'd never looked anything less than spectacular. Had he met Lord Frederick Stuart yet? Lord who? It was past midnight, and after a few pointed reminders from his wife about their subsequent commitments, that their guests finally prepared to depart. Lord and Lady Renworth were the last to leave. As Lady Renworth exited the front door, Lord Renworth turned around, pulled Gigi close, and whispered something into her ear, as if her husband weren't standing only 5 feet away. She laughed, a sudden swell of mirth, and literally shoved Lord Renworth out the door. "Let me guess, he proposed a ménage à trois?" Camden asked lightly, as they mounted the stairs side by side. "Felix? No, He's become a tiresome proponent of home and hearth since his marriage. In fact, he was arguing most tediously against the divorce the whole evening before you came along. She, too, kept up her winsome facade. Well, if you must know, he said, shag him silly. And are you going to take his sage advice? To scrap the divorce or to shag you silly? She chortled, her nimbus of sexual charisma unmistakable. I'm not accepting counsel from Lord Renworth at this juncture, or from anyone else stupid enough to think that I should remain married to you. Frankly, I would have expected better from him. Freddy considers him a friend. Poor Freddy, he thought. Well, she said, as they prepared to go their separate ways, should I expect a visit tonight? Unlikely. I don't wish to upset my stomach. But do be on the lookout for them in the coming days. She rolled her eyes. I can't wait. She had said the same thing to him once before, on the last day of their short-lived happiness. Then she had meant it, had been pink-cheeked with delight and anticipation, as had he. I can, he said. She sighed, a weary flutter of air. Go to hell, Camden. Chapter 8. December 1882. Theodora's letter arrived on the midday post 3 days after Camden's encounter with Miss Rowland. The sheaf of rose-scented paper notified him of her imminent marriage to a Polish nobleman, imminent only in the past tense. The letter had been composed 2 days before the date of the wedding, but not posted for another 3 days. Camden couldn't imagine Theodora being married to anyone else. People in general made her nervous. Even he did, to some extent, though she'd let him hold her hand and kiss her. She'd have been happiest far removed from the rest of humanity, a musical recluse in a chalet high up the Alps, with no neighbours but the cows at their summer pasture. He worried about her, but even as he did, he could not stem the tide of excitement that the news engendered. Desire, fascinated lust, sensual bedazzlement, covetousness by any other name was still rapacious. He wanted Miss Rowland. He wanted to laugh with her. He wanted to burn with her. And now he could, if he married her. Marriage, however, was a serious matter. The commitment of a lifetime, a decision not to be rushed. He tried to approach the matter rationally, but like idiotic, lust-addled young men since time immemorial, to which club he never imagined he'd belong, all he could think of was Miss Rowland's eagerness on their wedding night. She'd probably be the one to come into his room, rather than the other way around. She'd allow him to keep all the lights on, so he could visually devour her to his heart's content. She'd spread her legs wide, then wrap them tightly about him. And he might even make her look at what he'd do to her, so he could watch her flushed cheeks, her lust-glazed eyes, and listen to her moans and whimpers of pleasure. God, he would make love to her for days running. After a night of internal debate, during which much voluptuous fantasizing and very little sensible debate occurred, Camden resolved to put the choice to the fates. If Miss Rowland was there again by the stream that day, he'd propose to her within the week. If not, he'd take it as a sign that he should hold off until the end of next term to allow time for more solemn reflection. He spent the entire day at the bank of the brook, pacing up and down, all but climbing the naked trees. But she did not come. Not in the morning, not in the afternoon, not when the sky turned blue-black. And that was when he realized he was far gone. Not only was he immensely unhappy with the fates, but he'd decided that the fates could all go drown in a cesspit. He returned his horse to the stable and requested a brougham be readied for him immediately. The footman hesitated and looked inquiringly at Gigi. Her plate was still almost full. She pushed it aside. The plate disappeared to be replaced by another, a compote of pears.
"Gigi, you hardly ate anything," said Mrs. Rowland, picking up her fork. "I thought you liked venison."
Gigi picked up her own fork and excavated a cube of pear from the clear syrup. She was being too obvious in her preoccupation. Her mother never worried that she ate too little, quite the opposite. Mrs. Rowland usually feared that Gigi's appetite was too robust, that her corsets wouldn't lace tightly enough to achieve any decent approximation of the wasp waist. She stared at her fork and could not accomplish the simple task of putting it in her mouth. Her stomach churned already. She had no confidence it could handle the sugar-drenched piece of fruit. She set down the fork.
"I'm not that hungry tonight."
Merely terrified. What she'd done was in every way unprincipled and quite possibly criminal. Worse, she'd not only perpetrated a fraud, she'd made an incompetent mash of it. She'd been too impatient, her methods too crude. Any half-wit could pick up the rank odour of villainy and sniff the trail right to her door. What would Lord Tremaine do should he find out? And what would he think of her? A footman entered the dining room and spoke a few low words to Hollis, their butler. Hollis then approached Mrs. Rowland.
"Ma'am, Lord Tremaine is here. Should I ask him to wait until dinner's finished?"
It was a good thing Gigi had quit all pretense of eating, or she'd have dropped everything in her hand. Mrs. Rowland rose, radiant with excitement.
"Absolutely not. We shall go greet him this instant. Come, Gigi, I have a suspicion that Lord Tremaine didn't come all the way to see me."
Mrs. Rowland was no doubt hearing wedding bells, but scandal and ruin loomed large in Gigi's mind. She would live out the rest of her life like Miss What's-her-name, the mad old spinster in a wedding dress, laying waste to her estate and infecting everyone with her bitterness. She had no choice but to follow her mother, bleakly, grimly, a foot soldier who shared little of the general's optimism for victory and spoils, who saw only the bloodbath ahead. He was there, standing in the middle of the drawing-room, the epitome of her desires, the instrument of her downfall, the eligible young scion who groomed horses and ran just slightly shady games of probability.
"My Lord Tremaine," gushed Mrs. Rowland, "such a pleasure to see you, as always. What brings you to our humble abode at this unusual hour?"
"Mrs. Rowland, Miss Rowland." Did he glance at her? Was that a flash of intense longing or chagrin? "I do apologize for intruding on your evening."
"Nonsense," said Mrs. Rowland airily. "You know you're always welcome here, any time. Now do answer my question. My curiosity slays me."
"I'm here for a private word with Miss Rowland," replied Lord Tremaine, with breathtaking directness. "With your permission, of course, Mrs. Rowland." For the very first time in her life, Gigi felt faint without having first suffered a concussion. Either he'd come to denounce her, or he'd come to propose to her. Unthinkable as it might have been a few days ago, she fervently hoped it was the former. He'd castigate her for the scum that she was, she'd grovel hopelessly for forgiveness, then he'd depart and she'd lock herself in her room and bang her head on the wall until the wall gave.
"Most certainly," acceded Mrs. Rowland with admirable restraint.
She withdrew from the room, closing the door behind her. Gigi didn't dare look at him. She was certain that that in itself already betrayed her culpability. He drew close to her. Miss Rowland, will you marry me? More blood-curdling words she'd never heard. Her head snapped up. Her eyes met his.
3 days ago you were determined to marry someone else.
Today I'm determined to marry you.
What happened in the meantime to change your mind so drastically?
I received a letter from Miss von Schweppenberg. She has married into the princely house of Lobomirsky.
She thought to herself, no, she has not.
Gigi had plucked that name out of a book on European nobility she'd found in her mother's collection. She'd studied Miss von Schweppenberg's note, then composed her deception, carefully incorporating Miss von Schweppenberg's half-apologies and powerless wistfulness. Then she'd taken everything to Briar Meadows' gamekeeper, an old man who'd been a forger in his youth, and who regarded her with an indulgent, grandfatherly fondness.
I see, she said weakly. So you decided to be practical.
I suppose you could say part of my decision was motivated by pragmatism, he said quietly, coming so close that she could smell the cold, crisp scent of winter that still clung to his jacket. Though, for the life of me, I can't remember any of those reasons.
He tipped her chin up and kissed her.
She'd kissed men before, several, when she got bored at balls or chafed from her mother's strictures. She considered the activity more bizarre than interesting, and had sometimes studied the man she kissed with her eyes wide open, calculating the size of his debt. But from the moment Lord Tremaine's lips touched hers, she was consumed, like a child tasting a lump of sugar for the very first time, overcome by the sweetness of it all. His kiss was as light as meringue, as gentle as the opening notes of the Moonlight Sonata, and as nourishing as the first rain of spring after an endless winter drought. Light-headed and amazed, she drank in the kiss. Until simply being kissed by him wasn't enough any more. She cupped his face and kissed him back with something far beyond enthusiasm, something closer to desperation, tremulous and wild. She heard the muffled groan in his larynx, felt the physical change that signalled his arousal. He broke the kiss, pushed her an arm's length away, and stared at her, his breaths heavy and laboured. My God, if your mother wasn't on the other side of the door! He blinked, then blinked again. Was that a yes? It was not too late. She could still take the nobler path, confess everything, apologize, and keep her self-respect. And lose him. If he knew the truth, he would despise her. She couldn't face his anger or his scorn, couldn't live without him, not yet, not yet. She wrapped her arms about his waist and laid her cheek against his shoulder. Yes. The joy she felt at his fierce embrace was riddled with terror. But she'd made her choice. She would have him, for better or worse. She would keep him in the dark for as long as possible. And when they were married, she would look upon his sleeping form, marvel at her vast good fortune, and ignore the constant encroachment of fear that tainted her very soul. Camden had no idea he had it in him to be so happy. He was not the kind to derive unbridled joy from the pulse of the universe or any such nonsense. He never rolled out of bed wanting to breathe deeply of life itself. A poor man with well-meaning but inept parents to coddle and younger siblings to support had no time for such silly luxuries. But with her by his side, he couldn't help being exuberant. She possessed magical properties
strong and bracing as a draught of the finest vodka, and yet keeping him always at a delightful degree of tipsiness, that elusive point of equilibrium at which all the spheres of heaven came into exquisite alignment and a mere mortal sprouted wings. During their 3-week engagement, he called on her with a frequency that was positively indecent. On most days, riding over to Briar Meadow, both morning and afternoon, and accepting her mother's invitations to remain for tea and dinner, without so much as a perfunctory protest that he must not impose too much on his kind hostesses. He loved talking to Gigi. Her view of the world was as jaundiced and unromantic as his own. They agreed that, at the moment, neither of them amounted to anything, as he was no more responsible for his bloodline than she was for her million-pound inheritance. And yet, for an inveterate cynic, she was as easy to please as a puppy. The inadequate bouquets he scavenged from 12 Pillars' dilapidated greenhouse incited such euphoric responses that Julius Caesar, on his triumphant return to Rome after the conquest of Gaul, could not have been more madly thrilled. The rather modest engagement ring he bought her, with funds he'd saved for his passage to America and his first workshop, to be modelled after that of Herr Benz, brought her nearly to tears. The day before the wedding, he drove to her house and sent for her to meet him in front. No gloomy blue cape this time. She arrived like a column of flame, in a mantle of rich strawberry red, with rosy cheeks and wine-coloured lips to match. He grinned, as he always did now when he met her. He was an ass, to be sure, but a happy ass. "I have something for you," he said. She laughed giddily when she opened the small wrapped package to reveal a still-warm pork bun. "Now I truly have seen everything. Dare I guess you pillaged every last flower from your greenhouse yesterday?" She glanced about them in the mischievous way she had, signalling to him that she was about to come forward and kiss him, the public nature of her front lawn be damned. He stopped her, holding her forearms with his hands so that she couldn't get any closer. "I have something else for you." "I know what you have for me," she said saucily. "You wouldn't let me touch it yesterday."
"You can touch it today," he whispered.
"What?" She was still a virgin, after all. "Out here, where everyone can see us?" "Oh, yes." He laughed at her expression of shock and mortified interest.
"No."
"All right, then. I'll take the puppy and go home."
"A puppy?"
she squealed, like the 19-year-old she was.
"A puppy? Where is it? Where is it?"
He lifted the basket out of the carriage, but swung it away from her eager hands just as she reached for it.
"I understand you don't wish to touch it in public."
She grabbed the other end of the basket.
"Oh, give me, please! I'll do anything!"
He laughed and relented. She fumbled open the lid of the basket and out poked the brown and white head of a corgi puppy, wearing behind its neck a slightly lopsided blue bow made from ribbons Camden had pilfered from Claudia. Gigi squealed again and lifted the puppy. It regarded her with serious, intelligent eyes, not quite as thrilled as she was at their meeting, but pleased and well-behaved, nevertheless.
"Is it a boy or a girl?"
she inquired breathlessly, offering it pieces of the pork bun.
"How old is it? Does it have a name?"
Camden cast a glance at the puppy's rather obvious testicles. Perhaps she wasn't as knowledgeable as he'd thought.
"He's a boy, 10 weeks old, and I've decided to call him Croesus in honour of you."
"Croesus, my love," she touched her cheek to the puppy's nose. I shall get you a grand gilded water bowl, Croesus, and we shall be the best of friends for ever and ever."
At last she looked back at Camden.
"But how did you know I've always wanted a puppy?"
"Your mother told me. She said she preferred cats and you pined for a dog."
"When?"
"The day we met, after dinner. You were there, don't you remember?"
She shook her head.
"No, I don't."
"No doubt you were too busy looking at me."
Her hand came up to her mouth, but then a slow smile spread across her face.
"You noticed?"
He was tempted to tell her that not even at a memorably farcical soiree in St. Petersburg, during which both the hostess and the host attempted to seduce him, had he been ogled that much.
"I noticed."
"Oh, dear."
She buried her face against the puppy's neck. She was blushing, and, God help him, he had an erection the size of Bedfordshire.
"Thank you," she said, her voice muffled by Croesus's coat. "It's the best present anyone's ever given me."
He was touched and humbled. "It makes me happy to see you happy."
"Until tomorrow, then."
She leaned in and kissed him, a sweet, lingering kiss.
"I can't wait."
"It will be the longest 24 hours of my life," he said, kissing her one last time on the tip of her nose. "An eternity."
The next 24 hours turned out to be exactly that. An eternity. A hellish eternity.
Chapter 9. The 14th of May, 1893. The music didn't register at first. Gigi was not accustomed to hearing music in her own house when she hadn't paid for it. She dropped the report in her hand and listened to the faint but unmistakable sounds of a piano being assaulted. In his basket next to the bed, Croesus whimpered, snorted, and opened his eyes. Poor thing wasn't able to sleep well at night, perhaps because of all the naps he now took during the day. He shook his neck, rose on his short legs, and began his laborious ascent up the steps made especially for him, after he could no longer bound up on her bed with only the aid of the bedstool. She flung aside the counterpane and scooped him up.
"It's that stupid husband of mine," she said to the old pup. "Instead of banging me, he's banging the damn piano. Let's go and tell him to shut up."
Her husband started something dramatic and harsh as she descended the staircase. Bong, 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 bing, 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 bing. A piece composed by the overly somber Herr Beethoven, no doubt. With a sigh, Gigi threw open the door of the music room. He had changed into a silk dressing gown, as sleek and dark as the piano itself. His hair was rumpled, but otherwise he looked serious, intent, a man with a purpose. An excellent man, the consensus had always been. A most dutiful son, a caring brother, a faithful friend. All that and social graces, too. And a streak of subterranean viciousness that had to be experienced to be believed.
"I beg your pardon," she said, "but some of us need to sleep so that we can get up early in the morning."
He stopped playing and looked at her oddly. It took another moment to register that he wasn't looking at her, but at Croesus.
"Is that Croesus?" he frowned.
"It is." He left the piano bench and came next to her, studying Croesus, his frown deepening.
"What's the matter with him?"
She glanced down. Croesus seemed no different from how he usually was.
"Nothing," she said, her voice sharp with defensiveness. She liked to think that she provided Croesus a happy, comfortable life. "He's as well as an old dog can be."
Croesus was 10 and a half years of age, his once lustrous coat now dull and grey. His eyes were rheumy. He drooped, wheezed, tired easily, and ate poorly. But when he did have an appetite, he dined on foie gras sprinkled with sautéed mushrooms, and in ill health he was attended by London's best veterinarian. Camden reached out toward Croesus.
"Come here, old bloke."
Croesus regarded him with drowsy eyes. He didn't move. But neither did he protest when Camden simply took him.
"Do you remember me?" he said.
"I highly doubt it." Camden ignored her snippy answer.
"I've two pups in New York,"
he spoke to Croesus.
"Hannah and Bernard, a rambunctious pair. They'd be pleased to meet you some day."
She didn't understand why information so mundane and unremarkable as his having dogs should cause her a moment of scorching pain.
"I see you don't remember me."
He gave the fur behind Croesus's ear a wistful scratch.
"I have missed you."
"I'd like to have him back," Gigi said coldly. He complied, but not before holding Croesus close and kissing one of the old dog's ears.
"Your piano needs to be tuned."
"Nobody plays it."
"A shame."
He turned his head and gave the instrument an appreciative glance. "An Erard piano should be played."
"You can take it with you when you go back to New York.
A divorce present." She had ordered it as a wedding present for him, but it hadn't arrived until months after he left. His gaze returned to her.
"Thank you, I might, especially since it already has my initials inscribed."
He was standing close enough that she imagined she could smell him, the scent of a man after midnight, naked skin under silk dressing gown.
"Get to it, will you?" she murmured. "All this sexual skittishness is not very attractive in a man." "Yes, yes, I'm well aware, but the fact remains I'm loath to touch you."
"Turn off all the lights. Pretend I'm someone else."
"That would be difficult. You tend to be vocal."
She coloured. She couldn't help it.
"I'll sew my lips shut."
He shook his head slowly.
"It's no use. You breathe, and I'll know it's you."
10 years ago, she'd have taken it for a declaration of love. Her heart still gave a throb, a lonely echo. He bowed.
"One more piece, and I'm off to bed."
As she left, he began playing something as soft and haunting as the last roses of summer. She recognized it in two bars, Liebesträume. He and Mrs. Rowland had played it together that first night of their acquaintance. Even Gigi, incompetent musician that she was, could pick out that melody on the piano with one hand. Dream of love. All that she ever had with him. Mrs. Rowland's campaign to woo the Duke had hit a snag. For a day or so, things went terribly well. The case of Chateau Lafitte went promptly to Ludlow Court. A gracious thank-you note came back just as promptly, accompanied by a basket of apricot and peach preserves from Ludlow Court's own orchards. Then, nothing. Victoria sent an invitation to the Duke for her next charity gala. He gave a generous cheque, but declined to attend the event. 2 days later, she plucked up the audacity to call upon Ludlow Court in person, only to be told that the Duke was not at home. It had been 5 years since she resettled in Devon in her childhood house, which she'd purchased from her nephew. 5 years during which to observe the Duke's comings and goings. She knew perfectly well that he never went anywhere else except for his daily walk, which left her no choice but to intercept him during his walk again. She pretended to inspect the roses in the front garden, a pair of snipping scissors in hand,
Never mind that no self-respecting gardener ever did her cuttings in the middle of the afternoon. Her heart thumped as he came around the bend in the path at his usual hour. But by the time she'd manoeuvred herself next to the low gate by the path, she barely got a good afternoon out of him before he sailed on past. The next day she waited near the front of the garden, to no better results. The Duke refused to be drawn into chit-chat. Her comment on the weather only garnered the same good afternoon as the day before. For 3 days after that, it rained. He walked in mackintosh and galoshes, but she couldn't possibly work in the garden, or even pretend to, in a downpour. She gritted her teeth and decided to make an even greater nuisance of herself. She would walk with him. As God was her witness, she would bag, truss, and deliver this Duke to Gigi at whatever cost to her own dignity. Clad in a white walking dress and sensible walking boots, she waited in the front parlour of the cottage. When he appeared around the bend in the distance, she pounced, her tassel-fringed parasol in tow.
"I've decided to take up some exercise myself, Your Grace."
She smiled as she closed the garden gate behind her.
"Do you mind if I walk with you?"
He raised a pair of pince-nez from around his neck and looked down at her through the lenses. Goodness gracious, but the man was ducal in every little gesture. He was not unusually tall, about 5'10", but one chill look from him, and the Colossus of Rhodes would feel like a midget. He didn't give express permission. He merely dropped the pince-nez and nodded, murmuring, "Madam," and immediately resumed his walk, leaving Victoria to scamper in his wake, hurrying to catch up. She had known, of course, that he walked fast, but it didn't dawn upon her until she tried to catch up with him for 10 minutes just how fast he walked. For a rare moment, she wished she had Gigi's tremendous height instead of her own more demure 5'2". Chucking aside all ladylike restraints, she broke into a half-run, cursing the narrow confines of her skirts, and finally ended up at his side. She had prepared various openings, bits and pieces of local trivia, but by the time she finished enumerating interesting packets of historical details concerning the house next down the lane, she'd be 5 feet behind him again. And having been very ladylike all her life, she wasn't sure she could manage another run without expiring of apoplexy. So she got to the point.
"Would you care for dinner at my house 2 weeks from Wednesday, Your Grace? My daughter will be visiting that week. I'm sure she'd be delighted to meet you."
She'd have to go up to London and drag Gigi down, but that she'd worry about later.
"I'm a very fussy eater, Mrs. Rowland, and usually do not enjoy meals prepared by anyone but my own cook."
Drat it! Why must he be so difficult? What did a woman have to do to get him into her house? Dance naked in front of him? Then, no doubt, he'd complain of vertigo.
"I'm sure we could... But I might consider accepting your invitation if you would grant me a favour in return."
If it weren't so darned exhausting to keep up with him, she'd have halted in her tracks, stunned.
"I would be honoured. What might I do for you, Your Grace?"
"I am an admirer of the peace and quiet of the country life, as you well know," he said. Did she detect a trace of sarcasm in his voice? "But even the most ardent admirer of the country life sometimes misses the pleasures of the town."
"Indeed."
"I haven't gambled for the past 15 years.
This Duke, a gambler? But he was a recluse, a Homeric scholar with his nose buried in old parchment.
"I see,"
she said, though she didn't.
"I hear the siren call of a green baize table. But I do not wish to go to London to satisfy myself. Will you be so gracious as to play a few hands with me?" This time she did come to a dead stop.
"Me? Gamble?"
She'd never even bet a shilling. Gambling, in her opinion, was about the daftest thing a woman could do, other than divorcing a man who would one day be a duke.
"Of course, I would understand if you object to—"
"Not at all," she heard herself say. "I've no objections whatsoever to a bit of harmless betting."
"I like it more interesting than that," he said. £1,000 a hand."
"And I admire men who play for high stakes," she squeaked.
What was wrong with her? When she accepted giving up her dignity, she hadn't planned on surrendering every last ounce of her good sense as well. And lying outright, complimenting him on the most foolish, the most self-destructive trait a man could possess. There came a time in every good Protestant's life when she yearned for a simple, sin-absolving trip to the papist's confession booth.
"Very well, then," the Duke of Perrin nodded his approval. "Shall we set a date and a time?"
Chapter 10. January 1883.
"My dear cousin, the Grand Duke Alexei, is getting married today," said the Countess von Lofflerlich, more affectionately known as Aunt Plony, short for Apollonia. She was a second cousin of Camden's mother, and had come all the way from Nice to attend his wedding. "I hear the bride is some gold-digging nobody."
He would be called that very same, if he didn't stand in direct line of succession to a ducal title, Camden thought wryly. Instead, Gigi would bear the brunt of the snickering their hasty marriage was certain to engender for her feats of social mountaineering.
"Your noble cousin's wedding would have been the grander affair," said Camden.
"Very likely."
The elderly countess nodded, her hair a rare shade of pure silver and elaborately coiffed.
"Zut, I can't remember the bride's name. Eleanor von Schellenheim? Von Schäfer-Boyerdel? Or is her name not even Eleonora?"
Camden smiled. Aunt Plony was known for her prodigious memory. It must gall her to no end, not remembering something right at the tip of her tongue. He sat down next to her and poured more curacao into her digestif glass.
"Where's the bride from?"
"Somewhere on the border with Poland, I think."
"We know some people from there," he said. "Theodora, for one."
The countess frowned and tried to concentrate amid the lively conversation flowing in the great drawing-room at 12 Pillars. 30 of Camden's relatives had arrived from the continent to attend the wedding, despite the short notice, and his mother was ever so pleased to finally be able to receive people in a mansion, however neglected, of her own.
"Von Schweinfurt?"
Aunt Plony refused to give up.
"I do hate growing old. I never forgot a name when I was younger. Let's see. Von Schwanwisch?"
"Von Schnorbein? Von Schottenschein?"
Camden teased her. He was in a buoyant mood. Tomorrow, this time, he would be getting married to the most remarkable girl he'd ever met. And tomorrow night...
"Von Schreppenberg!" the countess exclaimed. "There! That's it. Haven't quite lost all my marbles after all."
"Von Schreppenberg?"
"He'd accidentally electrocuted himself once during an experiment at the Polytechnique. He felt exactly the same shock in his fingertips now."
"You mean Count Georg von Schreppenberg's widow?"
"Dear me, not quite that bad. His daughter. Theodora, that's her name. Not Eleonora, after all. Poor Alicia's quite smitten."
Something droned in the back of his head, an incipient alarm that he tried to dismiss. Titles that had their origins during the Holy Roman Empire went on in perpetuity to all male issue,
There could very well be another late Count Georg, from a lateral branch of the von Schweppenberg family, who had a marriageable daughter named Theodora. But what were the chances? No, they were speaking of his Theodora here, the one whose happiness he had once hoped to secure. But how? How could she marry two men in 1 month? The simple answer was that she couldn't. Either the Countess was wrong, or Theodora herself was wrong. A laughable choice, really. Of course Theodora would know the name of the man she was going to marry. The Countess had to be mistaken.
"I met her years ago, when we were in Peters," he said carefully. "I thought she married some Polish prince."
The Countess snorted.
"Now, wouldn't that be interesting? A real live bigamist. Unfortunately, I've no hope for it. According to Alicia, his intended is as pure as the Arctic ice field, with a mother who watches her every move. You must be mistaken, my boy."
The clamour in his head escalated. He poured a goblet full of the digestif and downed it in one long gulp. The cognac at the base of the liqueur burned in his throat, but the sensation barely registered.
"It's only 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a bit early to be doing your last bout of bachelor drinking, eh?" cackled Aunt Plony. "Not getting cold feet, are you?"
He wouldn't know if his feet were cold. He couldn't feel any of his limbs. The only thing he felt was confusion and a rising sense of peril, as if the solid ground beneath him had suddenly splintered, cracking dark webs of fissure and fracture as far as he could see. He rose and bowed to the Countess.
"Hardly, but I do beg your pardon, noble cousin. There is a small matter that requires my attention. I hope to see you again at dinner."
Camden couldn't think any better away from the drawing-room. He wandered the silent, draughty corridors, as bits and pieces of what Aunt Plony had said streaked about in his head like panicky hens facing a weasel invasion. He didn't exactly understand why, but he was scared witless. What frightened him most was that he knew, deep in his guts, that Aunt Plony had not been mistaken. At a turn in the hallway near the front of the house, he bumped right into a young footman carrying a tray of letters.
"Beg your pardon, my lord," the footman apologised immediately, and got down on all fours to retrieve the scattered missives.
As the footman gathered up the letters, Camden saw two addressed to him. He recognised the handwriting of his friends. The new university term had already started. They must be wondering why he hadn't returned yet. He had not informed his classmates of his upcoming marriage. He and Gigi had decided to throw a surprise reception in Paris, in the spacious apartment her agent had located for them on Montagne Sainte-Geneviève in the Quartier Latin, a stone's throw from his classes. A few essential items of furnishing had already been set up at the apartment, where a cook and a maid had also taken up residence in preparation for their arrival. He held out his hand for the tray.
"I'll take them, Elwood."
Elwood looked baffled.
"But, sir, Mr.